Support for the Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. With Thanksgiving almost here, this hour, we're focusing on a less gentle era in Native and white relations and the role George Washington played in it, that fraught period of the French and Indian Wars during the years leading up to our own revolution. At the time, Washington was a young surveyor who then engaged with Native Americans diplomatically and on the battlefield. That's the scene set by the author of the book we're talking about today. It's called The Indian World of George Washington, The First President, The First Americans, and The Birth of the Nation. The author is Colin Calloway. He's a professor of history and Native American studies at Dartmouth College. And we welcome your questions and comments throughout the hour. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. And Colin Calloway joins us from Dartmouth College. And Colin, welcome. It's really great to have you.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
So even though this is your area of expertise, as I said, you're a professor of history and Native American studies, what aspects of this story did you not either understand or appreciate before diving into all this research?
I think as a scholar of Native American history, I probably had some of my own stereotypes about George Washington. And I think perhaps what surprised me most in researching this book was the extent to which, as president, he wrestled with, let's call it, the moral dilemmas of federal Indian policy. And we can get into that later. But I think that was the takeaway surprise for me.
You were surprised that he wrestled. What was your impression that he had done?
Because he's the first president and the architect of United States Indian policy, I think the assumption was that that policy would be clear-cut and that his attitude toward Indian people would simply be that they were in the way and they needed to get out of the way. I think that was his attitude, but it was much more complex than that.
Well, we'll dive into some of that. And let's start at the beginning, where the book starts, because it's a period of time, I think, Colin, that, you know, a lot of Americans don't really get or appreciate. I'm talking about two decades before the American Revolution, the mid-1750s, a time period called the French and Indian Wars. So just set the scene for us. What were these wars really all about? You say they were a global conflict.
Yeah, I mean, basically, by the middle of the 18th century, the two superpowers of Europe, France and Britain, are squaring off, and they're squaring off in North America for control of the North American continent. And I think this is a period that, because it is, it so far precedes the Revolution, that for many Americans, it constitutes kind of ancient history, right? And ancient history doesn't really matter, it's irrelevant. But I think looking at that period is crucial to understanding how this nation develops, because with the benefit or the disadvantage of hindsight, it's very difficult not to assume that the outcome of all of this was preordained. But in the middle of the 18th century, much of what is now the United States, if you like, the heartland of America, was contested space. Britain was competing for it. The French were competing for it. But what we all also tend to forget is that there were multiple nations on the ground who in many cases controlled what was going on there. And those nations were Indian nations, and they were still powerful. And very often they were calling the shots. So that when the British or the British colonies, particularly Virginia, in the case of George Washington, are inserting themselves in the area of what is now roughly the Ohio Valley, there were no guarantees that things would work out in the way that they did. And I think many people would have expected things to have worked out somewhat differently.
So the French and Indian Wars, is it fair to describe them, Colin, as a proxy war between Britain and France?
In a lot of cases, that's true in that area of the country, in which native allies are fighting the British and the French and sometimes each other. The only qualifier I'd add is that we should not reduce native nations to the status of auxiliaries or pawns of the British and the French. They were fighting for their own reasons, and those reasons were essentially to defend and protect their own homelands and to defend and protect their own sovereignty.
Oh, that's interesting. And yeah. So they had their own reasons for joining either the British side or the French side. They were trying to ally themselves with whichever side might help them protect their lands, which they already saw as being taken away.
Yeah, the term I like to apply is foreign policies. Each native nation has and conducts its own foreign policies. And as we all know, foreign policies can shift according to circumstances. And it was very easy for the British or the French to accuse Indian people of being unreliable. But if we look for consistency there, that is protecting homelands, protecting sovereignty, then native actions make sense.
Well, why is this period referred to often, Colin, as the French and Indian Wars, plural, instead of war, singular? What's important about that?
Yeah. The French and Indian Wars is plural, is the term applied to on-again, off-again conflicts between Britain and France in North America and involving Indian people. And they had been going on since the end of the 17th century. The French and Indian War itself is the term that we usually apply to what in Europe is called the Seven Years' War.
I see.
And that's the culmination of these conflicts between Britain and France in North America.
You know, before we jump into the role George Washington played in all this, and it's fascinating, and many Americans have probably learned that George Washington, we're told, honed his military skills in the French and Indian Wars. That's why he was picked to lead American forces in the Revolution. But just two quick process questions for you, Colin, that I'm really curious about. First of all, I know you've answered this before. Why do you use the word Indian in your book instead of Native American?
I've answered it many times before, and it comes up all the time in my work. I'm a professor in a Native American studies program, but we often, and all of my colleagues are Native Americans, but we often refer themselves as Indian people or now more often indigenous people. Indian and Native American have one thing in common as terms for indigenous peoples of North America, and that is that I suppose they're both wrong, but they are collective terms, and sometimes we need collective terms. Some Native American studies programs call themselves American Indian Studies. We tend to call ourselves Native American. In the book, I use Indian more often than Native American because that was the term most often used at the time. It also makes the writing a little less clunky. If you're talking about American Indian policy, that's a little more lucid than American Native American policy. So I sometimes use them interchangeably, recognizing that essentially both are misnomers. They're collective terms, and of course, much better to refer to people by their individual names, their tribal nations.
And you have lots of, obviously, names of the tribal nations in here as well. One more process question for you, Colin. I'm really curious, how did you go about researching this book, given that there's probably a lot less documentation from the Native perspective than there is from the George Washington perspective? I'm sure George Washington has endless papers and letters and documentation. How do you tell this story in a balanced way when there's so little information from one side of the equation?
Exactly. One of the things that really assisted me in doing this research was that the papers of George Washington, like the papers of all of the founding fathers have been or are being assembled and digitized and are available online. And that was a huge assist. But of course, the question you ask is one that is a challenge in doing Native American history. And that is being able to access Native American points of view, perspectives, and voices. I actually don't hold with the notion that you can't write Indian history because Indian people are silent in the records. I actually think that's a myth put around by lazy historians. And I've been working in this era, I suppose, for 30, 40 years, including lots of work that I did in British Indian Department records many, many years ago. And even though Native opinions, Native voices, if you like, are filtered through interpreters and through people writing them down, there are lots and lots of documents recording what Indian people said, or at least recording what people thought they said. And using those documents and connecting those to Native American actions, you can actually begin to get a sense of what was going on, if you like, in Indian country. It's imperfect. It's totally out of balance, of course, with the records and the perspectives provided by those people who predominantly are making those records. But you can do it.
And you endeavor anyway. You make an effort. You don't just throw up your hands and say, there's nothing there, I can't do this work.
Yeah. And, I mean, I think a lot of progress can be made simply by starting from the perspective that the people that we're talking about, whoever they are human beings, and therefore you can look at their situations and say, what would they do in their own best interest? And if you ask that question, often that will help you to make sense of some things which, if you relied only on the British or the American or the French records, might not make sense.
We're talking today in The Exchange with Colin Calloway. He's a professor of history and Native American studies at Dartmouth College. The book we're talking about is called The Indian World of George Washington, The First President, The First Americans, and The Birth of the Nation. We welcome your questions and comments about this lesser-known time period leading up to the American Revolution. We'll look later also at Washington's policies toward Native Americans as a Revolutionary War commander and as president. You can join us with your comments and questions, 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. So, Colin, you say this book is not a biography of George Washington. How would you describe it then in terms of what kind of book it is? What's your sort of goal here?
Yes, I say it's not a biography, but I see that my publisher did say it was a biography.
I saw that. I noticed that.
However, it does take a biographical approach or a biographical structure. So even though this is a huge book, a very large book, it was in many ways one of the easier books that I've written, in part because the structure of it seemed so clear. My goal was to show how Indian people and Indian power and Indian land mattered in the life of George Washington, and how, if you like, Native Americans shaped the life of the man who shaped the nation. And so it was obvious, therefore, that I would follow his life story and show how and when Native Americans intersected with that life. So to that extent, I suppose you could say it was a biography, but I would qualify that by saying this is a partial biography in which it's looking at this strand of this life that people really haven't looked at in much depth before.
And what does that strand tell us about sort of the young nation that was starting to form around that time? What does George Washington's strand explain to us more broadly, Colin?
That Indian people, Indian power, and Indian affairs, for want of a better word, were just part of the daily life, part of the fabric, part of the atmosphere. Washington knew and dealt with Indian people. he knew lots of people who knew and dealt with Indian people. Doing business in Indian land was national currency almost. Indians were just a part of the landscape in a way that we today, looking back, I think, find it difficult to appreciate. And so what I see myself doing in this book is not, for want of a better term, rocket science. It's really just helping to recover a reality that was very different from how we might think of it, because our sense of how this country's history is developed accords Indian people such a minimal role, and in many ways in these early eras, they are, it seems, so easily dismissed. Washington never thought that. Washington never made that mistake. And he dealt with Indian people throughout his life because he had to deal with Indian people throughout his life.
Well, it's important for this story, Colin, that we know George Washington's background as a surveyor. So what did a surveyor do? How was their role especially important around this time period, you know, 1750, 1760?
Yes, if you look at maps of America in the middle of the 18th century, and especially you look at the territorial boundaries of Virginia and what Virginia claims as its territory, it seems almost inevitable that Virginia is going to be on the forefront of westward expansion. And when George Washington positions himself on the forefront of Virginian expansion, starting out as a teenager, working as a surveyor, which in 18th century Virginia, as in most of the colonies, was a big deal, because everybody who was ambitious of fortune and status was engaged in and looking to make money out of buying and selling Indian land and acquiring land, particularly with the expansion of the tobacco industry and later the cotton kingdom. And so the surveyors were the people who went out and marked out the land and very often identified the best land for their elite employers. And so this was a position that carried with it potential for making a small fortune oneself, for obtaining some land for oneself, as George Washington did. But surveyors were also essential players in this whole business of expansion onto Indian land. We often talk about it as if it's a natural process of American settlers, whether they're colonial or national, American settlers moving west and taking Indian land. But beneath that surface, there's a lot of business going on. You had to get deeds, you had to record lands, you had to make these things, if you like, legitimate. And the surveyors were crucial in that process.
All right. And after a break, we will talk about how George Washington's experience in this field as a surveyor out on Indian lands got him involved in the French and Indian Wars. You tell us in this book, Colin, he had more than one debacle in these wars, but came out with a great reputation. We will pick up on that thread after a short break. You can join us. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from UR subscribers and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Dartmouth professor Colin Calloway joins us on his book, The Indian World of George Washington, The First President, The First Americans, and The Birth of the Nation. It begins with the French and Indian Wars, how Washington first engaged with Native peoples in those conflicts, and later how he approached Native relations during the Revolutionary War and as president. Send us an email with your questions or comments. It's exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So, Colin, how did George Washington get involved in the French and Indian Wars? He was a surveyor. Did he show any interest in becoming a military officer?
Yes, he was interested in that because for somebody of his status, not first-tier gentry in Virginia, a career in the military was a way to reputation and to the kind of standing that he wanted. And getting a commission in the British Army, that would be a royal commission, was one of Washington's ambitions in the early part of his life. And not getting one was, I think, one cause of resentment, growing resentment against the British Empire. But Virginia's interests in the Ohio Valley, of course, conflicted with other people's interests in the Ohio Valley, French, English, and various Indian nations. And Washington's early experience as a surveyor meant that he is somebody with an interest and some experience in the West. And so as the French are increasing their presence in what is now Ohio, in the early 1750s, the governor of Virginia, Robert Dinwiddie, sends Washington as an emissary, you might say a messenger, to carry a letter to the French commanders in the Ohio country, basically telling them that this is King George's territory and they need to withdraw.
I'm sure that went over well.
Yeah, it was kind of, thanks for stopping by, I suppose, would be the answer, which I think actually was the answer that Dinwiddie expected. And what he was really doing was sending Washington to do this, to follow the proper protocols, to show that the French were unwilling to listen to reason, and also to stake out what's going on there, because in course of doing this, Washington had to travel from one French outpost to another. So he was actually gathering information. And Dinwiddie then turns around to the Virginia Assembly and says, look, the French threat is real. That money that you were reluctant to provide, now you need to provide it. And so Washington then is involved in a military expedition because the race is on for occupying the forks of what they called the forks of the Ohio. The Ohio River is seen as the key to the continent, and whoever can build a post or a fort at the forks of the Ohio will have a huge advantage in that. And the French are getting there first.
Right? Wow.
This is the site of present-day Pittsburgh, of course, that we're talking about.
And it's really interesting. And as a New Englander, I did not appreciate, Colin, how far down these French and Indian Wars went. You know, I think a lot of New Englanders tend to think of them as happening in New England, especially northern New England, along the Canadian border, upstate New York. I didn't realize how extensive these were, all the way down to, Pittsburgh and even Virginia.
And even further, yeah. And here in New England, of course, we're most familiar with Indian raiders coming down the Connecticut River, attacking places like Deerfield, taking captives on all that kind of thing. But the French and Indian Wars actually encompass the continent east of the Mississippi, and sometimes stretching down the Mississippi because, of course, there are French colonies and French initiatives, shall we say, down in that area. And so the repercussions of those conflicts affect people all across this part of the continent.
Well, and getting back to George Washington, and people can read the book for details of these battles, but you write, Colin, that he had several debacles, even though somehow he emerges from the French and Indian Wars with a reputation as a great officer, a leader, great military experience. But he had several bad experiences in these French and Indian Wars. Again, without going into the details of each battle, what sort of patterns or decision-making did you see in his participation, in his leadership during this time period that often led to bad results?
Yeah. Before I started writing this book, I read a lot of biographies of George Washington. And a lot of those biographies, particularly those written in an earlier era, talked about how his experience in the Ohio country kind of made him the man that he was.
Right.
But also they'd say things like, here it was that the young George Washington demonstrated those qualities of leadership that were to mark him for future greatness. Right. And I read through those records and I read through what happened there, and I'm sorry.
You're not buying it. So what sort of typical mistakes did he make? Yeah, go ahead.
He was a kid. I mean, he was 20, 21 years old. This was his first command. And I think part of those, in part, those statements misrepresent the reality of that country. This was a place where Indians called the shots, and the French and the Virginians both understood that they could not make any headway without Indian alliances. So they're both competing for Indian alliances. But we're not just talking about a block of people called Indians. The Ohio country was an extremely complicated place with different tribal nations competing for position, competing for allegiance to the French and the British, weighing which is the best way to go. And essentially what I think happened was, I don't want to get into the detail, but the situation in which George Washington finds himself when he's engaged in a skirmish with a detachment of French soldiers is one that is orchestrated and manipulated by an Indian leader, a Seneca, by the name of Tenarison, who was called the Half King, who for his own interests basically wanted to make sure that essentially France and England went to war, with the hope that when that happened, the various Indian nations would align with the English against the French. It's not exactly what happened, but he was the person who understood what was going on. And of course, he's a man who is a seasoned warrior, a diplomat, probably by now in his late 40s, 50s, and he's dealing with a kid from Virginia on his first
who thinks he knows everything.
Campaign.
Yeah, so George Washington underestimates Native peoples and their ability to figure out what is going to work for their advantage, their ability to sort of employ some skillful diplomacy. He basically walks in and thinks, you know, I know everything. I'm a gentrified person from Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's true. And I think for Washington, as for anybody else, going into that area of the world and trying to negotiate not only with Indian people, but negotiate the treacherous waters of diplomacy is a sharp learning curve. And there was no way he could have figured out how this was all working. And sometimes I think he's blindsided. And in a couple occasions, I also think he loses control of command. And certainly when he is forced to surrender his command at Fort Necessity, it's pretty clear that discipline has dissolved, and this is a situation that's beyond him. That's what prompts the British to send to North America the largest army that it's ever dispatched here, in the form of General Edward Braddock's army, which is to march across country and take the French fort, Fort Duquesne, the fort that the French have built at the forks of the Ohio. And Washington goes with that army, and that's another disaster, because Braddock underestimates the Indians, and it's the Indians who destroy that army. There are some French people there, and they're doing it to defend that French fort, but it's the Indians who completely defeat that army, and Washington comes out of that looking good for a couple of reasons. One is that he's one of the few officers to survive, and the other is that there's no question that he displays courage.
Even though he makes some mistakes, he does display a lot of bravery. And as you said, that sort of burnished his reputation so that he was then chosen to command U.S. forces in the American Revolution. And I wanted to ask you a couple more questions about the French and Indian Wars and then move on to how Washington worked with Native peoples during the Revolution, because that's really interesting. And you write that he was very well aware that he needed Indian alliances. I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us with your comments and questions about this book, this time period, some of the themes that we're hearing about how our founding father, George Washington, interacted with and fought with Native Americans. The number, 1-800-892-6477. Email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us. Again, you can give us a call at 1-800-892-6477. So, Colin, it's often said that Americans won the Revolutionary War because we, quote unquote, fought like natives, that our soldiers, through their experience in the French and Indian Wars, learned the best way to fight in the forest. How true is that? You talk about that a lot in the book.
Yeah, I think that's not very true.
Really? Okay.
Because a lot of the a lot of the officers who were at Braddock's defeat, a lot of men who fought and saw what happened at Braddock's defeat, were actually also present at another military disaster in 1791, where virtually the same thing happens to an American army. I think clearly that the experience for Europeans in fighting forest warfare in Indian country was searing, and it took adjustment, right? But the British adjusted as well, and the British adjusted even during the Seven Years' War. And during the Revolution, what Washington is actually trying to do with the Continental Army is to build an army that emulates the British Army in terms of discipline, in terms of standards, etc., etc. Now, Washington employs, if you like, guerrilla warfare in certain situations, as do the British. But that tends to be the kind of warfare that he applies in fighting Indian people.
I see. At one point, he even orders red coats for his forces, right, in one of these French and Indian battles.
Yeah, during the French and Indian War, he's very conscious of that he wants his soldiers to look like soldiers, and his idea of what soldiers look like, of course, are the British. And he says, if we have red coats, our soldiers will not only look the part, but they'll also look a lot better than those French soldiers.
Yeah, so who were sort of raggedy.
I think, as a young man in the French and Indian War, he's very conscious of appearances, and he's perhaps attaching more importance to the trappings of the military rather than the campaigns and the expeditions and the tactics. The French and Indian War is a real learning experience for Washington when he's posted on the Virginia frontier and finds that it's almost beyond his capability to protect the frontier, to protect settlements from fast-moving Indian raiding parties. And he says repeatedly, the only way we can effectively fight against Indians is to have Indian allies. And he knows that going into the Revolution.
Well, so let's talk about that. As you write, Washington knew Indian alliances were essential. So what does he do about it? And does he do it skillfully, Colin?
When the Revolution breaks out, most Indian people, I think, actually want to remain neutral. Well, not only that, but they're smart enough not to get involved in a domestic squabble, right? It looks like British people fighting British people. So contrary to the popular image and contrary to the Declaration of Independence, Indian people did not in general immediately jump into revolution because they had learned enough from the previous wars that wars that were fought in or across their homelands were going to be damaging to them. But right from the beginning, the British and the Americans, of course, are competing for Indian allies. And the thinking being that if Indians didn't fight for you, they're likely to be fighting against you. And the odds are stacked against the Americans because, not because the Indians particularly loved King George and the British, but because the British, during their colonial governance of North America, had at least made some attempt to protect Indian land. And Indian people recognized and remembered that, and Indian people also understood that one of the reasons Americans were fighting for their independence from Britain was because they wanted the freedom to get Indian land without British interference. And so, from a logical standpoint, Indian people looking at the situation and thinking, okay, we're going to be forced into one side or the other, it made sense for them to side with the British. Plus, not forgetting the fact, of course, that the British was the largest empire in the world. And the likelihood of Americans being victorious in this war might be pretty slim.
So Native people looked at this strategically, as anyone would, and said, you know, the odds look better for the British. And by the way, they seem a little more reliable when it comes to letting us keep our lands. So did most tribes side with the British, Colin?
Eventually, yes. Not immediately. Sometimes tribes line up with the British not until 1777, 1778, when American aggressions and, frankly, American atrocities often push them into that camp. But I think we need to remember, or I often say that we need to remember, that for the Americans, the war was a war about independence, but it was also a war about getting Indian land. For Indian people, the war was a war about defending their land, but it was also a war for their independence, which they felt would be threatened if the Americans were in charge. And so I think, as you said, their decisions are strategic. And certainly by the end of the war, more and more Indian people are lined up with the British than with the Americans.
All right. We will pick up on that thread after a short break, how Washington worked with that reality that you just described, Colin, how he perhaps tried to convince some Native peoples to come over to the American side. And then we will move on to George Washington as president. It's very interesting how his new administration approached Native people and their land and attempts by other Americans to get as much land as possible. All that's coming up. Plus, you can join us with an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or with a phone call, 1-800-892-6477.
Days are cold, the nights are long, and now is a great time to plan your escape. Support NHPR today with a year-end gift and you could win a trip for two to Costa Rica, so you can trade in the slush for a visit with a sloth. Stop fussing with your coat zipper and instead, fly by zipline through a vibrant jungle canopy. You'll be automatically entered to win this five-night stay to Costa Rica when you support the news you trust right now at nhpr.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, our favorite podcasts, whether you're spending time in Thanksgiving traffic or the Thanksgiving kitchen. What are your favorites? Send us an email with your favorite podcasts to exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning live at 9. This hour, we're talking with Dartmouth professor and author Colin Calloway on his book, The Indian World of George Washington, The First President, The First Americans, and the Birth of the Nation. You can join us with an email now, your questions and comments about this fascinating time period. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. And Colin, before we finish up the revolution and talk about George Washington's approach toward Native peoples as president, Grace sent us an email from Henniker. She says, from your guest's accent, I suspect he was not born in the United States. I wonder what sparked his interest in becoming a scholar in Native American history, and if his outsider approach to another nation's history gives him a unique and more honest appraisal of historical events here. And Grace, it's a great question. And I got to be honest, Colin, I had the same question myself.
Would you believe I've been asked that question before? I used to joke with people, I don't know, but if you ever find out, would you call my mom? She asked that question many times. But I think as I look at American history, and as I look at a life spent, I suppose, studying American history, the way I understand it is that as somebody growing up in the north of England, my mother's family was Scottish, my dad's family was English, and I grew up a couple of miles from where the Bronte sisters lived and wrote. The thing that struck me as distinctive about American history was the presence of indigenous peoples, Native Americans. But reading American history books then as a kid in the north of England, but then later in this country, I was often struck by the absence of Native peoples. And to me, American history often doesn't make sense unless it includes Native Americans. And so what I see myself doing, particularly in this book, but I would say in a lot of my other writings and teachings, is not trying to turn American history on its head and tell a completely different story, but by drawing attention to some other people's stories to get a better understanding of the story that we already have, right? That American history, the narrative that we tell, could not have unfolded the way that it did without Indian people. And yet, so often, Indian people are not there in that story. So I think that's my considered response to that question. And I think perspective is important. And obviously, I'm always conscious of the fact that I'm not Native American. And I suppose that I'm not really any kind of an American, even though now I'm an American citizen. I think taking a different view of this continental history in many ways can be useful. It's not obviously going to be the only perspective, but it maybe helps shift the lens half a turn.
Well, you talked about how most Native Americans, especially early on during the American Revolution, tried to stay neutral, but if they had to take a side, many saw the British as more aligned with their interests. After the Revolution, you write, at the Peace Treaty of Paris in 1783, the natives said, the king could not give away to America that which was not his to give. In other words, just because the Revolution is over and you won, new Americans, don't think you can come grab our land now. Can you just explain that quote? I found that really important.
Yes, because what's going on here is it's like a huge board game in which imperial powers hand land back and forward, right? And it goes back to this idea of the doctrine of discovery, right? That a Christian power landing on territory inhabited by people that are not Christians, right, can claim that land for their sovereign, and that that land can subsequently be transferred to somebody else. So you can exchange territory between Britain and France, France and Spain, etc. Or in the Peace of Paris in 1783, between Britain and the United States. Britain recognizes the independence of the United States and transfers to the United States all territory south of the Great Lakes, north of Florida, and east of the Mississippi. That is predominantly still, especially west of the Appalachian Mountains, Indian land.
Yeah, so they say, hey, this isn't yours to give away, King George.
Yeah, and Indian people actually felt they were winning the War of the Revolution in the West. The Revolution in the West continues well after Cornwallis surrenders at Yorktown. And Indian people are winning victories, and then suddenly they hear that the British have sold them down the river by not only ending the war, but as the price of ending the war, handing over their lands so that they now have to deal with the Americans. And the new Americans are saying, this land is our land because we got it from the British.
Wow.
And from an Indian perspective, it was never the British land to begin with.
That's a huge blow. Huge.
Yeah, huge blow.
So President Washington comes into office. I mean, we could talk much longer about that, but he comes into office. His first priority seems to me, from looking at your book, Colin, is peace. The Revolutionary War is long, preceded by the long French and Indian Wars. He wants peace. He eventually wants those Indian lands. But for now, it seems like he just wants everybody to calm down. So what does he say about that? What does he do about that?
So if you look at the United States in 1783, first of all, they're not united. Right? And again, that's our assumption is that all Americans fought in the Revolution, and once the Revolution was won, then the nation was good to go. That was not the case. Many of the states were not sure that they wanted to be part of a nation. It's still a very precarious situation. There's no guarantees that the Revolution will survive, that a nation will emerge from it. And there's a lot of tentative steps there in which, again, the presence and the threat of Indian power and Indian people is very real. But the United States in 1783 is in a situation similar to that of the British in 1763 at the end of the 7 years of French and Indian War. They've just won a very long and very expensive war, as a result of which they've acquired this huge chunk of North America. And now the question is, what will you do with it and how will you deal with it? And the United States, as Britain was in 1763, is essentially bankrupt, doesn't have any money in its treasury. And how is it going to build a nation without resources, without income, without revenue? Basically, all that it has is that land that Britain has transferred to it, but that's Indian land. So yes, Washington wants peace. The Americans, like everybody else, need a breather. But that peace has to include getting access to that land, or else basically the nation has no future.
So for economic reasons, for security reasons, Washington wants that land. But he's got some interesting statements about, sort of unbridled land grabbers. He wants this land to be taken in his way. So who are these unbridled land grabbers that Washington writes about, and how well do his dictates against them go over?
Yeah, if there was one person who knew about unbridled land grabbers, George Washington was that, because that was him. He spent his life trying to get his hands on Indian land, either for himself or for Virginia or for the United States. But now, of course, that he is presiding over a nation whose future existence depends on getting access to native lands, he wants this to be a national process. He does not want this to be a free-for-all in which speculators and individuals and states and everybody else is competing for new land. He wants this process, ideally, to be systematic, to be organized, and he hopes to be relatively bloodless. Because if you deal fairly with Indian people and give them a fair price for their land, hopefully they will gradually recede westward as American population moves west. That's his hope. And so especially north of the Ohio River, which is the area where the United States government can focus its efforts and attention, this process of westward expansion, as he and the Congress sees it, is one that needs to be laid out clearly, and it is laid out clearly in the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which essentially sets up the territorial system of the United States and the way in which territories become states, and it's the way in which most states have actually entered the United States. So he sees this as, if you like, a blueprint for the expansion and the growth of the nation. But he hopes that this is a process that can be implemented and carried out peacefully rather than militarily, because he also realizes in 1783 that the United States really has no military forces.
Well, people are just exhausted and tired of war. Yep. And as you said, people needed a break. So George Washington wants this to go out in an orderly fashion. He wants it to go out peacefully. And yet his main office of Indian Affairs is conducted out of the Department of War, not the State Department. Mm-hmm. So what does that choice say, Colin?
Well, you know what it says. Just as today, right, Indian Affairs is not conducting out of the Department of State, which you might think would be the logical place for Indian Affairs to be, given that Indian nations are nations within a nation. Indian Affairs are in the Department of the Interior, which deals with resources. But I think, obviously, at the time, placing Indian Affairs in the War Department gave an indication of expectations about how this might work. But the Secretary of War, Henry Knox, was no warmonger. In fact, he's one of the strongest voices in Washington's ear about how we need to conduct Indian affairs with an emphasis on peace, not on war. And that's both a moral imperative and a realistic one, because wars are extremely expensive and wars can go horribly wrong, as they will find out. And so there's an interesting correspondence between Washington and the Secretary of War, in which these two guys are really wrestling with how we can do what we have to do, that is, get the Indians land as the basis of this new nation we're building, but at the same time do it peacefully and even do it honorably in a way that will make us look good to the nations of the world who are looking at us to see how is this new democracy going to work, that will make us look good, frankly, to posterity and to our own citizens. They are conscious of the fact that they are building, they have this experiment in Republican government, and one of the criterion by which it will be judged is how it deals with Native people.
Well,
they have a dilemma.
And they were concerned about safety. Alexander Hamilton writes that the new nation is hemmed in by Europe on one side and Indians on the other. And the Western tribes, he says, are America's natural enemies. So there was a real concern about security, while at the same time, you know, Washington wanted this to unfold peacefully. Just to wrap it up, we got an email from Nancy earlier who basically wanted you to connect the dots for us, Colin, between some of the policies that George Washington put in place and how they set the tone for what happens to Native Americans eventually in our history.
Yeah. And Washington, I think, was aware of this. As first president, he realizes he's setting precedents, and Indian policy is a huge issue, right? It's often said that the two main areas where the founding fathers left a business unfinished, or if you like, dropped the ball, was slavery and Indian affairs. Right? And so Washington is conscious that decisions made now will shape American relations with Indian people going forward. And so the question that the United States faced in 1783 after independence was won and they're creating a new nation is, what place will there be for Indians in this new nation? Will there be a place? Washington believed there could be. Not, I think, a place for powerful Indian tribes occupying large chunks of territory and owning land communally, right? Because Washington was all about property. But he believed that if Indian people could give up living like Indian people and adapt and adopt so that they lived more like American people, then they could live with American people. There could be a place for Indians in this new republic. It's in some ways a little naive. In some ways it's self-serving, but that was what he hoped for. Things change. In 1803, the United States acquires Louisiana Territory. Now there's a place where you can move Indian people, and this becomes the genesis of the Indian Removal Act in 1830 and the attitudes adopted by President Andrew Jackson, which is quite clear. There is no place for Indian people, and there doesn't need to be. We can move them west of the Mississippi, what today we would call ethnic cleansing.
Okay. Well, Nancy, thank you for the email. And Colin, we will wrap it up there. I really appreciate you taking time out for us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Colin Calloway, professor of history and Native American studies at Dartmouth College. The book we talked about is called The Indian World of George Washington, The First President, The First Americans, and The Birth of the Nation. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.